The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend.
It's the truth. These days we have to dig for it, right? Tonight I'm exploring how the truth serves us and when it doesn't. When we want to manipulate, when we want power, when we want to rule the world, perhaps. Truth is the topic of my sharing now tonight, just starting. That's for me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. We humans are capable of telling the truth or telling lies. Humans, Homo sapiens, need a method by which we can cooperate, because we're actually the only mammals that can cooperate in extremely large numbers. That's even allowing for the so-called higher animals that also tend to move in groups, like chimpanzees and elephants. But we humans do more complicated things, so we need more complex cooperation with each other. And when it comes to the truth, there are things we need the truth for and things where fiction serves us better. If we're going to be building atom bombs, for instance, we need truths. We need physical truths. We need the correct combination of physical particles. We need proper non-fictional physical theory. And we need proper truthful coordination between the people building the bomb. I'm paraphrasing now from an editorial by Yuval Harari in the New York Times. He points out that in general, to have power over all the other animals on the planet, and maybe specific power over specific Homo sapiens on the planet, we need to believe in common stories. But the stories don't need to be true. As Harari points out, you can unite millions of people by making them believe in what could be complete fictions. Stories about race, stories about God, stories about economics, stories about our common history. The funny thing is, as humans, we know many more truths than any other animal, but we also believe in a lot more nonsense. We're both the smartest and the most gullible inhabitants of planet Earth, he writes. Rabbits don't know that E equals MC squared. On the other hand, they don't believe in mythologies either, as far as we know. A hippo isn't going to crash an aeroplane into the World Trade Center in the hope of being rewarded with 72 virgin hippos in the afterlife. So there are times when a higher knowledge and grasp of the truth serves us well. But there are times when we seem to manage well employing fiction versus the truth to get our needs met. Fiction, Harari writes, actually has three inherent advantages over the truth. The truth is a universal, but fictions can be and tend to be local. So if we want to distinguish our tribe from foreigners, a fictional story can serve us better. Suppose, for instance, we teach the members of our tribe to believe that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. That's not a terribly effective tribal myth. Because if, say, I encounter someone in the jungle who tells me the sun rises in the east, it might indicate they're a loyal member of the tribe, but it might just as well indicate that they're an intelligent foreigner who reached the same conclusion about sunrise and sunset independently of being a member of any tribe. So it works better if you teach tribe members something specific. Like, the sun is the eye of a giant frog that each day leaps across the sky, since few foreigners are likely to hit upon that particular concept independent of the tribe. It's like having a kind of tribal password when you make up something, whereas the truth is accessible to anyone. So that's one advantage. The second, Harari points out, has to do with the handicap principle. The handicap principle says that reliable signals must be costly in some way to the signaler. Otherwise, they can easily be faked by pretenders and cheaters. He gives as an example male peacocks. They signal their fitness to female peacocks by sporting an enormous colourful tail, the tail being a heavy, cumbersome thing that can attract predators. That shows their fitness because only a truly fit peacock can survive with this handicap. And the same sort of thing happens with stories. If you're aiming for political loyalty with a true story, anyone can go for that true story. But if you can get them to believe something ridiculous and outlandish, that exacts a greater cost and therefore signals greater loyalty by the person willing to believe. It doesn't really prove anything if you believe your leader when they tell you the truth, but if you continue to believe them when they're telling you fabrications, well, how more loyal could you be than that? Harari points out that shrewd leaders might sometimes deliberately say nonsensical things so that they can distinguish their truly loyal supporters from their fair-weather ones. Sound familiar?
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows, that's how it goes. Everybody knows. And everybody knows that it's now or never. Everybody knows that it's me or you. And everybody knows that you live forever. Oh, when you've done a line or two. Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. And everybody knows. That the plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. And everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. From the bloody cross on top of Calvary to the beach in Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Oh, everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX 93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is whether to tell the truth or not. I've been quoting from an editorial by Yuval Harari in the New York Times, where he suggests that perpetrating a fiction, particularly if you're a politician, can serve you better than telling the truth, exacting more loyalty, confirming you as a better, more committed member of the tribe if you accept something sketchy or unconfirmed. I just outlined from his article a couple of instances where that might be the case. And here's a third reason or occasion when fiction might serve you better than the truth. And it's a fairly obvious one, which is this. The truth is often painful and disturbing. So if you go for it and you're trying to sway people to your side, well, if you've upset or depressed them, they might not want to be there. Harari claims that any American presidential candidate who tells American people the unalloyed truth and nothing but the truth has an unalloyed guarantee of losing the election. And it's true of any presidential candidate all over the world, he suggests. So what's the long-term fallout from this? Once people get in the habit of accepting and even persuaded into believing absurd fictions, the whole culture will adjust to accommodate that. It would affect economic decisions, military strategies, and technologies. Then again, there's the concept of cognitive dissonance. So often, zealots and fanatics can compartmentalize by behaving rationally in some areas and nonsensically in others. Harari is an Israeli, so he mentions the whole Nazi racial theory and points out that it was a bogus pseudoscience, and though they tried to buttress it with scientific evidence, the Nazis nevertheless had to silence their rational faculties in order to develop a brief strong enough to justify murdering millions of people. Yet when it came to the practicalities of designing gas chambers and preparing timetables for the Auschwitz trains, their rationality was intact. And obviously that doesn't just apply to the Nazis in history. There have been plenty of other fanatical groups who've managed to motivate the mobs with their fictions. He says this ability to compartmentalize rationality probably exists in the structure of our brain, because different parts of our brain are responsible for different modes of thinking. Humans can subconsciously deactivate the parts of the brain that are crucial for skeptical thinking and then reactivate them at will. He quotes Eichmann as being able to shut down his prefrontal cortex while Hitler was giving an impassioned speech, and then to reboot it while poring over the Auschwitz train schedule. In any event, fictional stories routinely triumph over the truth in human history, and scholars have known this for thousands of years, which is why they often had to choose between serving the truth or serving social harmony. Was it better to unite people by making sure everyone believed in the same fiction, or go for possible disharmony by letting people know the truth? Socrates, who chose the truth, was executed. Whilst all those other major power brokers of history, whether they were Christian priests, Confucian mandarins, or communist ideologues, put harmony and unity above the truth, and that made them super powerful. So one might argue that it's incumbent on a leader to choose the most harmonious, unifying route over the most truthful one. Unfortunately, what we seem to have these days is a less harmonious, less unifying, while still less truthful leadership than we should. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James. This is Lagunas KX 935, a listener-supported, member-supported, one and only public radio station of Laguna Beach, California. Truth is the topic I'm exploring on the show tonight. And I'm going to quote now from another editorial in the New York Times, this one by Trish Hall, who was the former op-ed editor of the Times. Her approach to telling the truth is a far less skeptical one. She recommends being straightforward, being honest, being to the point, while being warm and being personal, particularly if you're trying to get people to change their minds and getting them to say yes rather than no. Being a writer, she's talking about telling the truth or not through the discipline of writing, whether it's what she does, editorial writing, or through our everyday Twitters or messaging or emails. But even she's discovered that facts don't matter all that much as a tool in persuasion, because people have a preference for the information that matches what they already believe. More important than facts is emotion. Then again, people get angry if you mislead them and they discover it. So if you're going to use an anecdote to argue your case for your particular truth, make sure it rings true. Because if it doesn't, and you incite an emotional reaction from your reader or whomever you're trying to convince about something, then you're going to lose them. So, for instance, if you text somebody when you're running late, traffic on the freeway, subway broke down, see you soon, it's going to irritate them. If they know you're lying because they came to, let's say, the same bar where you're meeting by the same method of transportation, for instance, far better just to say, 15 minutes late, so sorry, first drink on me. Succinct, you've apologized, you haven't lied, unnecessarily. The other thing she suggests is be quick and to the point. If you're on a dating app, don't be too wordy. People are busy. They want the essence of the thing. So here's what she says don't say on your dating site. For instance, I'm looking for a man or woman who loves fun and can keep up with me. I ski black diamonds. I do triathlons. I speak 5 languages. I volunteer for hospice. And on weekends, I make 5-course meals. Please be interesting in the morning, engaged to the fullest in your work life, and be both fun and relaxing in the evenings, and always eager to go to the newest play, the newest restaurant, and the nearest gallery. Instead, write something like, I like to read novels until 3 in the morning, binge watch TV on weekends, and walk aimlessly through the city. I know, riveting. Honest, direct, short. And then there's the asking for what you want. People underestimate the value of just asking. You don't have to beat around the bush. It's in our nature to want to help. So don't apologize for asking for it. Just be direct. The worst that can happen is you ask, you're rejected. You haven't really lost anything. People simply fear rejection, so that's why they don't ask. They're anxious, they're embarrassed. But think of it the other way around. Someone asks you for directions, or what's the best place for me to see while I'm here in town, or best restaurant to eat in. If you're in a hurry, you say, sorry, you don't have the time. Big deal, they're rejected. But most of us, if we do have the time, are very happy to give people the sum of our experience. And unless we're terribly perverse and get a buzz from lying for no reason whatsoever, we're going to give them the truth. We're not going to feed them wrong information, right? Okay, so what about invitations? Say you're the one giving the invitation. It's a charity you're involved with and you want people to show up for a meeting that you're throwing to discuss it. Which of these emails would you write to elicit the answer you want? Number 1. Dear everyone, I'm involved with a group that gives scholarships to young people and I'm hoping that some of you might be able to attend our celebration next Monday. Or, dear Anne, Mary, Joe, Jane, I'm involved with a group that gives scholarships to young people, and I'm hoping that you can attend our celebration next Monday. A number of people you know, including John and Jim, will be there. Can I leave your name at the door? It's at 6 p.m. at the Historical Society building. So here's a case where a few more words is helpful and will probably elicit a more honest response from the invitee. Now, you also need to know your audience when you're wanting a positive, truthful response. And that means listening hard to the people that you care about and learning personal stuff about them. We want to be understood, which means we need to also understand people. If you're writing a condolence letter, for instance, the more you know about a person, the more truthful, heartfelt words you can write to them. So which of these condolence letters do you think has more resonance for the receiver? One, I was so sorry to hear about your father. It's very hard to go through that. I'm thinking of you. Perfectly pleasant, you haven't lied, but you haven't revealed any greater truths either. How about, dear whomever, I was so sorry to hear about your father. I remember the time he came to my Thanksgiving, and you and I imagined for just a minute what it would be like if he got together with my mother. He was kind and charming, like you are, and I'm glad I got a chance to meet him. I'm thinking of you. That's the kind of note that you remember, right? The one that squeezes in all the truthful personal information. And something more general when writing notes. Don't try to sound too smart by using complicated or technical jargon unless it's someone in your particular field that you know is used to communicating that way. So staying truthful and not lying is going to be helpful in a letter thanking somebody for interviewing you, for instance. The same rules apply. Find something specific to them to relay, to show that you've taken the time to take the measure of who they are. Again, the two different approaches. The first, a bland and blanket statement that doesn't really say much. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk today. I'm certain I will be able to contribute a great deal to your organization, especially by optimizing your relationships with the media, employing the multi-level skills I have developed over the years. As opposed to, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. I have some additional thoughts on how you could get more media attention without adding any more staff members. For one, I think you could do more with Instagram stories. I'm happy to send more details if you would like that. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you. No jargon, simple, clear, straightforward, giving a little of yourself, offering a little understanding of the person you're communicating with. A different political approach, a warmer, friendlier, more positive one, a less skeptical one, one that you can better live with, I'd imagine, if you're a thoughtful, ethical person. You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight is about the truth, whether it's been serving us to tell it or to lie. That depends to some extent on your position and objective in life, obviously. Jeff Hancock, whose TED Talk I'm going to play you in a minute, is Canadian, a social scientist professor at Stanford, but one of his first jobs was as a customs officer for Canada. So it was his task to ensure that someone coming into the country was telling the truth. Since then, in his job as director of the Stanford Social Media Lab, his work revolves around understanding how you and I are being affected psychologically and interpersonally by a lot of the questionable stuff being promulgated through social media, like, for instance, fake news.
Of course, not all deception hits the news. Much of the deception is every day. In fact, a lot of research shows that we all lie once or twice a day. Lying is very pervasive. It's this pervasiveness, the fact that we can tell the truth or make something up, that has fascinated people throughout history. Diogenes with his lantern back in Greece. What he was looking for? A single honest man, and he died without finding one. And we have Confucius in the East, who was really concerned with sincerity. Not only that you walked the walk or talked the talk, but that you believed in what you were doing. You believed in your principles.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, big-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dickies.
That was not Confucius, but John Lennon, of course, begging, "Give me the truth." The topic of my Sharon Hour tonight with me, Sharon James, on Goodness Kicks 935. And here again, expounding on that topic in his TED Talk, is Jeff Hancock, social scientist, former defender of Canadian borders.
I learned a lot about deception while doing my duty in customs, one of which was that most of what I thought I knew about deception was wrong, and I'll tell you about some of that tonight. But even since just 1995, 96, the way we communicate has been completely transformed. We email, we text, we Skype, we Facebook. Almost every aspect of human communication has been changed. And of course, that's had an impact on deception. Let me tell you a little bit about a couple of new deceptions we've been tracking and documenting. They're called the Butler, the Sock Puppet, and the Chinese Water Army. Sounds a little bit like a weird book, but actually they're all new types of lies. Let's start with the Butlers. Here's an example of one. Anybody ever written "on my way"? Then you've also lied. We're never on our way. We're thinking about going on our way. Here's another one. "Sorry I didn't respond to you earlier. My battery was dead." Your battery wasn't dead. You weren't in a dead zone. You just didn't want to respond to that person that time. Here's the last one. You're talking to somebody and you say, "Oh, sorry, got work, gotta go." But really you're just bored. You want to talk to somebody else. Each of these is about a relationship. And this is a 24/7 connected world. Once you get my cell phone number, you can literally be in touch with me 24 hours a day. And so these lies are being used by people to create a buffer, like the Butler used to do, between us and the connections to everybody else. But they're very special. They use ambiguity that comes from using technology. You don't know where I am or what I'm doing or who I'm with. And they're aimed at protecting the relationships. These aren't just people being jerks. These are people that are saying, "Look, I don't want to talk to you now, or I didn't want to talk to you then, but I still care about you. Our relationship is still important." Now, the sock puppet, on the other hand, is a totally different animal. The sock puppet isn't about ambiguity per se, it's about identity. Let me give you a recent example. R.J. Ellery, bestseller author in Britain. Here's a reviewer online on Amazon by Nicodemus Jones. "Whatever else it might do, it will touch your soul." And of course, you might suspect Nicodemus Jones is R.J. Ellery. He wrote very, very positive reviews about himself. Surprise, surprise. Now, this sock puppet stuff isn't actually that new. Walt Whitman also did this back in the day before there was internet technology. Sock puppet becomes interesting when we get to scale, which is the domain of the Chinese Water Army. Chinese Water Army refers to thousands of people in China that are paid small amounts of money to produce content. It could be reviews, it could be propaganda. The government hires these people, companies hire them, all over the place. In North America, we call this astroturfing. And astroturfing is very common now. There's a lot of concerns about it. We see this especially with product reviews, book reviews, everything from hotels to whether that toaster is a good toaster or not. Now, looking at these three types of deception, you might think, wow, the internet is really making us a deceptive species, especially when you think about the astroturfing, where we can see deception brought up to scale. But actually, what I've been finding is very different from that. Let's put aside the online anonymous sex chat rooms. I can assure you there's deception there. And let's put aside the Nigerian prince who's emailed you about getting the 43 million out of the country. Let's forget about that guy too. Let's focus on the conversations between our friends and our family and our coworkers and our loved ones. Those are the conversations that really matter. What's technology to do to deception with those folks? Here's a couple of studies. One of the studies we do are called diary studies, in which we ask people to record all of their conversations and all of their lies for 7 days. And what we can do then is calculate how many lies took place per conversation within a medium. And the finding that we get that surprises people the most is that email is the most honest of those three media. And it really throws people for a loop because we think, well, there's no nonverbal cues, so why don't you lie more? The phone, in contrast, the most lies. Again and again and again, we see the phone is the device that people lie on the most. This tends to be very different from what people expect. And perhaps it's because of the Butler lie ambiguities I was telling you about. What about resumes? We did a study in which we had people apply for a job, and they could apply for a job either with a traditional paper resume or on LinkedIn, which is a social networking site like Facebook, but for professionals. It involves the same information as a resume. And what we found, to many people's surprise, was that those LinkedIn resumes were more honest on the things that mattered to employers, like your responsibilities or your skills at your previous job. How about Facebook itself? You know, we always think that, hey, there are these idealized versions. People are just showing the best things that happen in their lives. I've thought that many times. My friends, no way they can be that cool and have that good of a life. Well, one study tested this by examining people's personalities. They had 4 good friends of a person judge their personality. Then they had strangers, many strangers, judge the person's personality just from Facebook. And what they found was those judgments of personality were pretty much identical, highly correlated, meaning that Facebook profiles really do reflect our actual personality. All right, what about online dating? I mean, that's a pretty deceptive space. I'm sure you all have friends that have used online dating, and they would tell you about that guy that had no hair when he came, or the woman that didn't look at all like her photo.
I had a friend, a contemporary, and a guy showed up at her door with an oxygen tent attached. No mention, of course, of that in his profile. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James. My topic tonight is to tell the truth, when we do, when we don't. Social scientist Jeff Hancock was really interested in discovering whether there was any truth to the fact that online dating was a forum where people didn't tell the truth.
And so what we did is we brought online daters into the lab, and then we measured them. We got their height up against the wall. We put them on a scale, got their weight. Ladies love that. And then we actually got their driver's license to get their age. And what we found was very, very interesting. All the guys were lying about their height. In fact, they lied about their height about 9/10 of an inch, what we say in the lab as strong rounding up. You get to 5/8 and 1/10 and boom, 5'9". But what's really important here is what we found was 80% of our participants did indeed lie on one of those dimensions, but they always lied by a little bit. One of the reasons is pretty simple. If you go to a date and you're completely different than what you said, game over, right? So people lied frequently, but they lied subtly, not too much. They were constrained. A lot of online communication, technologically mediated communication, is more honest than face-to-face. That really is strange. How do we explain this? Well, to do that, one thing is we can look at the deception detection literature. It's a very old literature by now. It's coming up on 50 years. It's been reviewed many times. There's been thousands of trials, hundreds of studies. And there's some really compelling findings. The first is we're really bad at detecting deception. Really bad. 54% accuracy on average when you have to tell if somebody that just said a statement is lying or not. Why is it so bad? Well, it has to do with Pinocchio's nose. If I were to ask you guys, what do you rely on when you're looking at somebody and you want to find out if they're lying? What cue do you pay attention to? Most of you would say that one of the cues you look at is the eyes. The eyes are the window of the soul. And you're not alone. Around the world, almost every culture, one of the top cues is eyes. But the research over the last 50 years says there's actually no reliable cue to deception, which blew me away. And it's one of the hard lessons I learned when I was a customs officer. The eyes do not tell us whether somebody's lying or not. Some situations, yes, high stakes, maybe their pupils dilate, their pitch goes up, their body movements change a little bit, but not all the time, not for everybody, it's not reliable. The other thing is that just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm going to lie. It's common sense, but one important finding is that we lie for a reason. We lie to protect ourselves or for our own gain or for somebody else's gain. There are some pathological liars, but they make up a tiny portion of the population. We lie for a reason. Just because people can't see us doesn't mean we're going to necessarily lie. But I think there's actually something much more interesting and fundamental going on here. For me, the next big thing, big idea, we can find by going way back in history to the origins of language. Most linguists agree that we started speaking somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 years ago. That's a long time ago. A lot of humans have lived since then. We've been talking, I guess, about fires and caves and saber-toothed tigers. I don't know what they talked about, but they were doing a lot of talking. There's a lot of humans evolving speaking. About 100 billion people, in fact. What's important, though, is that writing only emerged about 5,000 years ago. So what that means is that all the people before there was any writing, every word that they ever said, every utterance disappeared. No trace. Evanescent, gone. So we've been evolving to talk in a way in which there is no record. In fact, even the next big change to writing was only 500 years ago, now with the printing press, which is very recent in our past, and literacy rates remained incredibly low right up until World War II. So even the people of the last two millennia, most of the words they ever said, disappeared. Let's turn to now, the networked age. How many of you have recorded something today? Anybody do any writing today? Did anybody write a word? Almost every single person recorded something. Right now, we've probably recorded more than almost all of human pre-ancient history. That is crazy. We're entering this amazing period of flux in human evolution, where we've evolved to speak in a way in which our words disappear, but we're in an environment where we're recording everything. In fact, I think in the very near future, it's not just what we write that will be recorded, everything we do will be recorded. What does that mean? What's the next big idea from that? Well, as a social scientist, this is the most amazing thing I have ever even dreamed of. Now, I can look at all of those words that used to, for millennia, disappear. I can look at lies that before were said and then gone. You remember those astroturfing reviews that we were talking about before? Well, when they write a fake review, they have to post it somewhere and it's left behind for us. So one thing that we did, I'll give you an example, is we paid people to write some fake reviews. One of these reviews is fake. The person never was at the James Hotel. The other review is real. The person stayed there. Now your task now is to decide which review is fake.
Okay, listener, I'm going to read you the reviews that Jeff Hancock, the social scientist whose TED Talk you're listening to now on KX935's The Sharer Now, has given to his audience to thoroughly inspect. He's asking, which is the fake review, A or B? And I'm going to read them to you now. Okay, A, I've stayed at many hotels, traveling for both business and pleasure, and I can honestly say that the James is tops. And by the way, the James Hotel is not related in any way to me, Sharon James. The service at the hotel is first class. The rooms are modern and very comfortable. The location is perfect, within walking distance to all of the great sights and restaurants. Highly recommend to both business travelers and couples. Here's the other review. B. My husband and I stayed at the James Chicago Hotel for our anniversary. This place is fantastic. We knew as soon as we arrived, we made the right choice. The rooms are beautiful, capital letters, and the staff very attentive and wonderful. The area of the hotel is great. Since I love to shop, I couldn't ask for more. We'll definitely, spelled A-T-L-Y, be back to Chicago, and we will for sure be back to the James Chicago. So, listener, which do you think is fake? Here was my reasoning. The one that misspelt definitely with an A and no E and sounded a bit more folksy and personal seemed more authentic. So I thought, well, that would be the one that's real. On the other hand, I thought, well, somebody clever would do that in order to make you feel that the review was authentic. So I figured the more standard, gushingly approving one was probably the real one, and they sort of reinforced each other by appearing together. So my guess is B was the fake, and I was listening to this talk in real time in the same way that you're listening to it, so I didn't know the answer, and you'll have to take that on faith. Let's find out. Do you agree that B is the fake, or do you think it's A?
All right. How many of you believe that A is the fake? All right. About half. And how many of you think that B is? All right. Slightly more for B. Excellent. Here's the answer. B is a fake. Well done, second group. All right. So why do I care about this? Well, what I can do now with my colleagues in computer science is we can create computer algorithms that can analyze the linguistic traces of deception. Let me highlight a couple of things here in the fake review. The first is that liars tend to think about narrative. They make up a story, who and what happened. And that's what happened here. Our fake reviewers talked about who they were with and what they were doing. They also used the first person singular, I. They were inserting themselves into the hotel review, trying to convince you were there. In contrast, the people that wrote the reviews that were actually there, their bodies were actually entered the physical space, they talked a lot more about spatial information. They said how big the bathroom was, or they said, here's how far shopping is from the hotel. Now, you guys did pretty well. Most people perform at chance at this task. Our computer algorithm is very accurate, much more accurate than humans can be. And it's not going to be accurate all the time. This isn't a deception detection machine to tell if your girlfriend's lying to you on text messaging. We believe that every lie now, every type of lie, fake hotel reviews, fake shoe reviews, your girlfriend cheating on you with text messaging, those are all different lies that are going to have different patterns of language. But because everything's recorded now, we can look at all of those kinds of lies. As I said, as a social scientist, this is transformational. We're going to be able to learn so much more about human thought and expression, about everything from love to attitudes, because everything is being recorded now. But what does it mean for the average citizen? What does it mean for us in our lives? Well, let's forget deception for a bit. One of the big ideas, I believe, is that we're leaving these huge traces behind. My inbox and outbox for email is massive, and I never look at it. I write all the time, but I never look at my record, at my trace. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that, where we can reflect on who we are by looking at what we wrote, what we said, what we did. Now, if we bring it back to deception, there's a couple of takeaway things here. First, lying online can be very dangerous, right? Not only are you leaving a record for yourself on your machine, but you're leaving a record on the person that you were lying to. And you're also leaving them around for me to analyze with some computer algorithms. But when it comes to lying and what we want to do with our lives, I think we can go back to Diogenes and Confucius. And they were less concerned about whether to lie or not to lie, and more concerned about being true to the self. And I think this is really important. Now, when you are about to say or do something, we can think, do I want this to be part of my legacy, part of my personal record? Because in the digital age we live in now, in the networked age, we are all leaving a record.
A sobering thought, particularly as we don't always behave rationally as humans. We have a complicated relationship with the truth. And I want to play you now on this KX935's The Sharon Hour, the topic of truth, a TED Talk by the always erudite and interesting psychologist Daniel Ariely. His particular experience has led him to a metaphor as well as a practical application for the study of truths versus fictions and deceptions.
My interest in irrational behavior started many years ago in hospital. I was burned very badly. And if you spend a lot of time in hospital, you'll see a lot of types of irrationalities. And the one that particularly bothered me in the burn department was the process by which the nurses took the bandage off me. Now, you must have all taken a Band-Aid off at some point, and you must have wondered what's the right approach. Do you rip it off quickly, short duration but high intensity, or do you take your Band-Aid off slowly? You take a long time, but each second is not as painful. Which one of those is the right approach? The nurses in my department thought that the right approach was the ripping one. So they would grab hold, and they would rip, and they would grab hold, and they would rip. And because I had 70% of my body burned, it would take about an hour. And as you can imagine, I hated that moment of ripping with incredible intensity. And I would try to reason with them and say, why don't we try something else? Why don't we take it a little longer, maybe 2 hours instead of an hour, and have less of this intensity? And the nurses told me two things. They told me that they had the right model of the patient, that they knew what was the right thing to do to minimize my pain. And they also told me that the word patient doesn't mean to make suggestions or interfere. And there wasn't much I could do, and they kept on doing what they were doing. And about 3 years later, when I left the hospital, I started studying at the university. I was still interested in this question of how do you take bandages of burn patients. So originally, I didn't have much money, so I went to a hardware store, and I bought a carpenter's vise, and I would bring people to the lab, and I would put their finger in it, and I would crunch it a little bit. And I would crunch it for long periods and short periods, and pain it went up and pain it went down, and with breaks and without breaks, all kinds of versions of pain. And when I finished hurting people a little bit, I would ask them, so how painful was this? Or if you had to choose between the last two, which one would you choose? I kept on doing this for a while, and then like all good academic projects, I got more funding, I moved to sounds, electrical shocks, I even had a pain suit that I could get people to feel much more pain. But at the end of this process, what I learned was that the nurses were wrong. Here were wonderful people with good intentions and plenty of experience, and nevertheless, they were getting things wrong predictably all the time. It turns out that because we don't encode duration in the way that we encode intensity, I would have had less pain if the duration would have been longer and the intensity was lower. It turns out it would have been better to start with my face, which was much more painful, and move toward my legs, giving me a trend of improvement over time that would have been also less painful. And it also turns out it would have been good to give me breaks in the middle to kind of recuperate from the pain. All of these would have been great things to do, and my nurses had no idea. And from that point on, I started thinking, are the nurses the only people in the world who get things wrong in this particular decision, or is it a more general case? And it turns out it's a more general case. There's a lot of mistakes we do.
And that's the thing with the truth as well. We make mistakes. We misjudge. We don't always explore deeply enough to get to the truth, even the most well-intentioned of us. Or we lie, and sometimes it's to protect ourselves, and sometimes it's to advance ourselves. But often it's just because we don't always have the right paradigm for getting through life, or even any given moment. Truth is the topic of my Sharonar tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX93.5. Psychologist Daniel Ariely went down a particular path to pursue a particular truth, but his process is also a metaphor for pursuing any kind of truth, including deceptions and or self-deceptions.
I want to talk to you about cheating. My interest in cheating started when Enron came on the scene, exploded all of a sudden, and I started thinking about what is happening here. Is it the case that there is kind of a few bad apples who are capable of doing these things, or are we talking a more endemic situation that many people are actually capable of behaving this way? So, like we usually do, I decided to do a simple experiment, and here's how it went. If you were in the experiment, I would pass you a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems that everybody could solve, but I wouldn't give you enough time. When the 5 minutes were over, I would say, pass me the sheets of paper and I'll pay you $1 per question. People did this, I would pay people $4 for their task. On average, people would solve 4 problems. Other people I would tempt to cheat. I would pass the sheet of paper. When the 5 minutes are over, I would say, please shred the piece of paper, put the little pieces in your pocket or in your backpack, and tell me how many questions you got correctly. People now solve 7 questions on average. Now, it wasn't as if there was a few bad apples, a few people who cheated a lot. Instead, what we saw is a lot of people who cheat a little bit. Now, in the economic theory, cheating is a very simple cost-benefit analysis. You say, what's the probability of being caught? How much do I stand to gain from cheating? And how much punishment would I get if I get caught? And you weigh these options out, you do the simple cost-benefit analysis, and you decide whether it's worthwhile to commit the crime or not. So we tried to test this. For some people, we varied how much money they could get away with, how much money they could steal. We paid them 10 cents per correct question, 50 cents, $1, $5, $10 per correct question. You would expect that as the amount of money on the table increases, people would cheat more, but in fact, it wasn't the case. We got a lot of people cheating, but still by a little bit. What about the probability of being caught? Some people shredded half the sheet of paper, so there was some evidence left. Some people shredded the whole sheet of paper. Some people shredded everything, went out of the room, and paid themselves from a ball of money that had over $100. You would expect that as the probability of being caught goes down, people would cheat more, but again, this was not the case. Again, a lot of people cheated by a little bit, and they were unsensitive to these economic incentives. So we said, if people are not sensitive to the economic rational theory explanations, to these forces, what could be going on? And we thought, maybe what is happening is that there are two forces. At one hand, we all want to look at ourselves in the mirror and feel good about ourselves. So we don't want to cheat. On the other hand, we can cheat a little bit and still feel good about ourselves. So maybe what is happening is that there's a level of cheating we can't go over, but we can still benefit from cheating at a low degree as long as it doesn't change our impressions about ourselves. We call this like a personal fudge factor. Now, how would you test a personal fudge factor? Initially, we said, what can we do to shrink the fudge factor? So we got people to the lab and we said, we have 2 tasks for you today. First, we asked half the people to recall either 10 books they read in high school or to recall the 10 commandments. And then we tempted them with cheating. Turns out, the people who tried to recall the 10 commandments, and in our sample, nobody could recall the 10 commandments, but those people who tried to recall the 10 commandments, given the opportunity to cheat, did not cheat at all. It wasn't that the more religious people, the people who remembered more of the commandments, cheated less, and the less religious people, the people who couldn't remember almost any commandment, cheated more. The moment people thought about trying to recall the 10 commandments, they stopped cheating. In fact, even when we give self-declared atheists the task of swearing on the Bible and we give them a chance to cheat, they don't cheat at all. Now, 10 commandments is something that is hard to bring into the education system, so we said, why don't we get people to sign the honor code? So we got people to sign. I understand that this short survey falls under the MIT honor code. Then they shredded it. No cheating whatsoever. And this is particularly interesting because MIT doesn't have an honor code. So all this was about decreasing the fudge factor. What about increasing the fudge factor? The first experiment, I walked around MIT and I distributed 6 packs of Cokes in their refrigerators. These were common refrigerators for the undergrads. And I came back to measure what we technically call the half-lifetime of Coke. How long does it last in the refrigerators? And you can expect it doesn't last very long. People take it. In contrast, I took a plate with 6 $1 bills and I left those plates in the same refrigerators. No bill ever disappeared. Now, this is not a good social science experiment. So to do it better, I did the same experiment as I described to you before. A third of the people, we passed the sheet, they gave it back to us. A third of the people, we passed it, they shredded it, they came to us and said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X dollars. A third of the people, when they finished shredding the piece of paper, they came to us and said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X tokens. We did not pay them with dollars, we paid them with something else. And then they took this something else, they walked 12 feet to the side and exchanged it for dollars. Think about the following intuition. How bad would you feel about taking a pencil from work home compared to how bad would you feel about taking 10 cents from a petty cash box? These things feel very different. Would being a step removed from cash for a few seconds by being paid by token make a difference? Our subjects double their cheating. I'll tell you what I think about this in the stock market in a minute. But this did not solve the big problem I had with Enron yet, because in Enron there's also a social element. People see each other behaving. In fact, every day when we open the news, we see examples of people cheating. What does this cause us? So we did another experiment. We got a big group of students to be in the experiment, and we prepaid them. So everybody got an envelope with all the money for the experiment, and we told them at the end to pay us back the money they didn't make. Okay? The same thing happens when we give people the opportunity to cheat. They cheat. They cheat just by a little bit. All the same. But in this experiment, we also hired an acting student. This acting student stood up after 30 seconds and said, I solved everything. What do I do now? And the experimenter said, if you finished everything, go home. That's it. The task is finished. So now we had a student, an acting student, that was a part of the group. Nobody knew it was an actor. And they clearly cheated in a very, very serious way. What would happen to the other people in the group? Will they cheat more or will they cheat less? Here is what happens. It turns out it depends on what kind of sweatshirt they're wearing. Here's the thing. We ran this at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And at Pittsburgh, there are two big universities, Carnegie Mellon and University of Pittsburgh. All of the subjects sitting in the experiment were Carnegie Mellon students. When the actor was getting up, he was actually a Carnegie Mellon student, but he was a part of their group, cheating went up. But when he actually had the University of Pittsburgh sweatshirt, cheating went down. Now, this is important because remember, when the moment the student stood up, it made it clear to everybody that they could get away with cheating. Because the experimenter said, you finished everything, go home, and they worked with the money. So it wasn't so much about the probability of being caught again, it was about the norms for cheating. If somebody from our in-group cheats and we see them cheating, we feel it's more appropriate as a group to behave this way. But if it's somebody from another group, these terrible people, I mean, not terrible in this, but somebody we don't want to associate ourselves with, from another university, another group, all of a sudden people's awareness of honesty goes up, a little bit like the Ten Commandments experiment, and people cheat even less. So what have we learned from this about cheating? We've learned that a lot of people can cheat. They cheat just by a little bit. When we remind people about their morality, they cheat less. When we get bigger distance from cheating, from the object of money, for example, people cheat more. And when we see things of cheating around us, particularly if it's a part of our in-group, cheating goes up. Now, if we think about this in terms of the stock market, think about what happens. What happens in a situation when you create something where you pay people a lot of money to see reality in a slightly distorted way? Would they not be able to see it this way? Of course they would. What happens when you do other things, like you remove things from money? You call them stock or stock option, derivatives, mortgage-backed securities. Could it be that with those more distant things, it's not a token for one second, it's something that is many steps removed from money for much longer time, could it be that people would cheat even more? And what happened to the social environment when people see other people behave around them? I think all of those forces worked in a very bad way in the stock market. More generally, I want to tell you something about behavioral economics. We have many intuitions in our life, and the point is that many of these intuitions are wrong. The question is, are we going to test those intuitions? We can think about how we're going to test this intuition in our private life, in our business life, and most particularly when it goes to policy, when we think about things like No Child Left Behind, when you create new stock markets, when you create other policies, taxation, healthcare, and so on. And the difficulty of testing our intuition was the big lesson I learned when I went back to the nurses to talk to them. So I went back to talk to them and tell them what I found out about removing bandages. And I learned two interesting things. One was that my favorite nurse, Etty, told me that I did not take her pain into consideration. She said, of course, you know, it was very painful for you, but think about me as a nurse. removing the bandages of somebody I liked and had to do it repeatedly over a long period of time, creating so much torture, was not something that was good for me too. And she said maybe part of the reason was that it was difficult for her. But it was actually more interesting than that, because she said, I did not think that your intuition was right. I thought my intuition was correct. So if you think about all of your intuitions, think about it's very hard to believe that your intuition is wrong. And she said, given the fact that she thought her intuition was right, it was very difficult for her to accept doing a difficult experiment to try and check whether she was wrong. But the fact, this is the situation we're all in all the time. We have very strong intuitions about all kinds of things. Our own ability, how the economy works, how we should pay school teachers. But unless we start testing those intuitions, we're not going to do better. And just think about how better my life would have been if these nurses would have been willing to check their intuition, and how everything would have been better. We would just start doing more systematic experimentation of our intuitions.
An interesting man, isn't he, Daniel Ariely? So listener, my takeaway from this particular research on truth-telling is that we're all a little bit dishonest. We're talking the average person now, not someone at the pathological extreme. And to what extent we're dishonest, we're really taking our cues from other members of our tribe, particularly those members that we look up to. And our tribe can be our national affiliation, our socioeconomic one, our religious one, our political one, our racial one. But our tribe is also Homo sapiens, the human race. And given that we're only a little bit this or that, given our humanity, are we nevertheless being edged down the path of being a little bit less than a little bit untruthful and a little bit less honest than we've been in the past? Are we evolving as a species where being a little bit more dishonest and a little bit more untruthful is becoming accepted practice? It's something to think about, which is what I try to do on this The Sharing Hour, now at an end for tonight. If you want to hear this show again, you can do so on iTunes or go to our dedicated website, kx935.com, something I encourage you to do anyway because we have some wonderful events coming up, including a raffle for a fantastic antique car that you can read about there, and also become a member while you're visiting the site if you're not already. If you want to hear the podcast of this show, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharing-hour. That's Sharing without the G, a pun on my name, Owl with the H. Meantime, this is Sharon James wishing you a great and truth-filled week ahead and hoping you'll come back for more topics, interviews, conversations on The Sharing Hour every Monday night at 9 p.m.